without any answer, and with a sense of having done something shameful. He handed over all the now revolting business of the estate to his bailiff, and set off next day to a remote district to see his friend, Sivieski, who had splendid marshes for double snipes in his neighborhood, and had lately written, asking him to keep a long-standing promise to visit him. The snipe marsh in the Sarovsky district had long tempted Levin, but he had continually put off this visit on account of his work on the estate. Now he was glad to get away from the neighborhood of the Shcherbatskys, and still more from his farm work, especially on a shooting expedition, which always served as the best consolation in trouble. Chapter 25. In the Sarovsky district there was neither railway nor mail coach, and Levin drove there with his own horses in his Tarantus. He stopped halfway at a well-to-do peasant's to feed his horses. A bald, well-preserved old man with a broad, red beard, bristled on his cheeks, opened the gate, squeezing against the gatepost to let the troika pass. Directing the coachman to a place under the shed in the big, clean, tidy new yard, with charred wooden plows in it, the old man asked Levin to come into the room. A cleanly dressed young housewife, with clogs on her bare feet, was scrubbing the floor in the new outer room. She was frightened by the dog that ran in after Levin and uttered a shriek, but began laughing at her own fright at once when she was told the dog would not hurt her. Pointing out to Levin with her bare arm the door into the room, she bent down again, hiding her handsome face, and went on scrubbing. "Would you like a samovar?" she asked. "Yes, please." The room was a big one, with a tile stove and a partition dividing it into two. Under the icon stood a table painted in patterns, a bench, and two chairs. Near the entrance was a dresser full of crockery. The shutters were closed, there were few flies, and it was so clean that Levin was anxious that Laska, who had been running along the road and bathing in puddles, should not muddy the floor, and ordered her to a place in the corner by the door. After looking round the room, Levin went out in the backyard. The comely young housewife in clogs, swinging the empty pails on the yoke, ran on before him to the well for water. "Look sharp, my girl," the old man shouted after her good-humoredly, and he walked up to Levin. "Well, sir, are you going to Nikolai Ivanovich Sivieski? He comes to us, too," he began chatting, leaning his elbows on the railing of the steps. In the middle of the old man's account of his acquaintance with Sivieski, the gates creaked again, and laborers came into the yard from the fields with wooden plows and harrows. The horses, harnessed to the plows and harrows, were sleek and fat. The laborers were obviously of the household. Two were young men in cotton print shirts and caps. The two others were hired laborers in homespun shirts, one an old man, the other a young fellow. Moving off from the steps, the old man went up to the horses and began unharnessing them. "What have they been plowing?" asked Levin. "Plowing up potatoes. We rent a bit of land, too. Fedat, don't get out the gelding, but take it to the trough, and we'll put another in harness." "Oh, father, about the plowshares I ordered. Has he brought them along?" asked the big, robust fellow, obviously the old man's son. "There, in the sledge," answered the old man, rolling up the reins he had taken off and flinging them on the ground. "You can put them right while they have dinner." The comely young housewife came into the outer room with the full pails dragging at her shoulders. More women came on the scene from somewhere, young and handsome, middle-aged, old and ugly, with children and without children. The samovar was beginning to sing. The laborers and the family, having disposed of the horses, came in to dinner. Levin, getting his provisions out of his carriage, invited the old man to take tea with him. "Well, I have had some today already," said the old man, obviously accepting the invitation with pleasure. "Well, be it so, for company." Over their tea, Levin heard all about the old man's farming. 10 years before, the old man had rented 120 desiatinas from the lady who owned them, and a year ago he had bought them and rented another 300 from a neighboring landowner. A small part of the land, the worst part, he let out for rent, while some 40 desiatinas of arable land he cultivated himself, with his family and two hired laborers. The old man complained that things were going badly, but Levin saw that he simply did so from a feeling of propriety, and that his farm was in a flourishing condition. If it had been unsuccessful, he would not have bought land at 105 rubles, the desiatina. He would not have married off his three sons and a nephew. He would not have rebuilt twice after fires, and each time on a larger scale. In spite of the old man's complaints, it was evident that he was proud, and justly proud, of his prosperity. Proud of his sons, his nephew, his sons' wives, his horses, his cows, and especially of the fact that he was keeping all this farming going. From his conversation with the old man, Levin realized he was not averse to new methods either. He had planted a great many potatoes, and his potatoes, that Levin had seen driving past, were already past flowering and beginning to ripen, whereas Levin's were only just coming into flower. He plowed the ground for his potatoes with a modern plow borrowed from a neighboring landowner. He sowed wheat. The trifling fact that, thinning out his rye, the old man used the rye he thinned out for his horses, struck Levin especially. How many times had Levin seen this special fodder wasted and tried to get it saved, but always it had turned out to be impossible. This peasant had done so, and he could not say enough in praise of it as food for the beasts. What have the wenches to do? They carry it out in bundles to the roadside, and the cart brings it away. Well, we landowners can't manage well with our laborers, said Levin, handing him a glass of tea. Thanks, said the old man, and he took the glass but refused sugar, pointing to a bit he had left. There's no getting along with them, said he. They're simply waste. Look at Shvyatsky, for instance. He knows what the land's like, first rate, yet there's not much of a crop to boast of. It's not looked after enough. That's all it is. But you work your land with hired laborers? We're all peasants together. We go into everything ourselves. If a man's no use, he can go, and we can manage by ourselves. Father Finnegan wants some tar, said the young woman in the clogs coming in. Yes, yes, that's how it is, sir, said the old man, getting up, and crossing himself lingeringly, he thanked Levin and went out. When Levin went in the kitchen to call his coachman, he saw the whole family of men at dinner. The women were standing up waiting on them. The young, robust son was telling something funny with his mouth full of buckwheat porridge, and they were all laughing. The woman in the clogs was pouring cabbage soup into a bowl, laughing most merrily of all. Very probably the comely face of the young woman in the clogs had a good deal to do with the impression of well-being this peasant household made upon Levin. But the impression was so strong that Levin could never get rid of it. And all the way from the old peasants to Shvyatsky's, he kept recalling this peasant farm as though there was something in this impression demanding his special attention. Chapter 26. Shvyatsky was the marshal of his district. He was 5 years older than Levin and had been long married. His sister-in-law, a young girl Levin liked very much, lived in his house, and Levin knew that Shvyatsky and his wife would have greatly liked to marry the girl to him. He knew this with certainty, as so-called eligible young men always know it, though he could never have brought himself to speak of it to anyone. And he also knew that, although he wanted to get married, and although by every token this very attractive girl would make an excellent wife, he could no more have married her, even if he had not been in love with Kitty Shvyatskaya, than he could have flown up to the sky. And this knowledge poisoned the pleasure he had hoped to find in the visit to Shvyatsky. On getting Shvyatsky's letter with the invitation for shooting, Levin had immediately thought of this, but in spite of it, he had made up his mind that Shvyatsky's having such views of him was simply his own groundless supposition, and so he would go notwithstanding. Besides, at the bottom of his heart, he had a desire to try himself, to put himself to the test in regard to this girl. The Shvyatsky's home life was exceedingly pleasant, and Shvyatsky himself the best type of Zemstvo man that Levin knew, was very interesting to him. Zhivyatsky was one of those people, always a source of wonder to Levin, whose convictions, very logical though never original, go one way by themselves, while their life, exceedingly definite and firm in its course, goes its way quite apart and almost always in direct contradiction to their convictions. Zhivyatsky was an extremely advanced man. He despised the nobility and believed the mass of the nobility to be secretly in favor of serfdom, and only concealing their views out of cowardice. He regarded Russia as a ruined country rather after the style of Turkey, and the government of Russia as so bad that he never permitted himself to criticize its doings seriously. And yet he was a functionary of that government, and a model marshal of nobility. And when he drove about, he always wore his cap with a cockade and red band. He considered human life only tolerable abroad, and went abroad to stay at every opportunity. And at the same time, he carried on a complex and improved system of agriculture in Russia, and with extreme interest followed everything and knew everything that was being done in Russia. He considered the Russian peasant as occupying a stage of development intermediate between the ape and the man. And at the same time, in the days of Zemstvo election, no one was readier to shake hands with the peasants and listen to their opinion. He believed neither in God nor the devil, but was much concerned about the question of the improvement of the clergy and the maintenance of their revenues, and took special trouble to keep up the church in his village. On the woman question, he was on the side of the extreme advocates of complete liberty for women, and especially their right to labor. But he lived with his wife on such terms that their affectionate, childless home life was the admiration of everyone, and arranged his wife's life so that she did nothing and could do nothing but share her husband's preoccupations in spending their time as happily and as agreeably as possible. If it had not been a characteristic of Levin to put the most favorable interpretation on people, Zhivyatsky's character would have presented no doubt nor difficulty to him. He would have said to himself, a fool or a knave, and everything would have seemed clear. But he could not say a fool, because Zhivyatsky was unmistakably clever, and moreover a highly cultivated man who was exceptionally modest over his culture. There was not a subject he knew nothing of, but he did not display his knowledge except when he was compelled to do so. Still less could Levin say that he was a knave, as Zhivyatsky was unmistakably an honest, good-hearted, sensible man who worked good-humoredly, keenly, and perseveringly at his work, which was held in high honor by everyone about him. And certainly he had never consciously done, and was indeed incapable of doing, anything base. Levin tried to understand him, and could not understand him, and looked at him and his life as at a living enigma. Levin and he were very friendly, and so Levin used to venture to sound Zhivyatsky to try to get at the very foundation of his view of life, but it was always in vain. Every time Levin tried to penetrate beyond the outer chambers of Zhivyatsky's mind, which were hospitably open to all, he noticed that Zhivyatsky was slightly disconcerted. Faint signs of alarm were visible in his eyes, as though he were afraid Levin would understand him, and he would give him a kindly, good-humored rebuff. Just now, since his disenchantment with farming, Levin was particularly glad to stay with Zhivyatsky. Apart from the fact that the sight of this happy and affectionate couple, so pleased with themselves and everyone else, and their well-ordered home had always a cheering effect on Levin, he felt a longing, now that he was so dissatisfied with his own life, to get at that secret in Zhivyatsky which gave him such clarity, definiteness, and good courage in life. Moreover, Levin knew that at Zhivyatsky's he would meet the landowners of the neighborhood, and it was particularly interesting for him just now to hear and take part in those rural conversations concerning crops, laborers' wages, and so on, which Levin was aware are conventionally regarded as something very low, but which seemed to him just now to constitute the one subject of importance. It was not perhaps of importance in the days of serfdom, and it may not be of importance in England. In both cases, the conditions of agriculture are firmly established. But among us now, when everything has been turned topsy-turvy and is only just taking shape, the question what form these conditions will take is the one question of importance in Russia, thought Levin. The shooting turned out to be poorer than Levin expected. The marsh was dry and there were no snipe at all. He walked about the whole day and only brought back 3 birds, but to make up for that he brought back, as he always did from shooting, an excellent appetite, excellent spirits, and that keen intellectual mood which with him always accompanied violent physical exertion. And while out shooting, when he seemed to be thinking of nothing at all, the old man and his family would time and again come to mind, and the impression of them seemed to claim not merely his attention, but the solution of some question connected with them. In the evening at tea, 2 landowners who had come about some business connected with a wardship or of the party, and the interesting conversation Levin had been looking forward to sprang up. Levin was sitting beside his hostess at the tea table and was obliged to keep up a conversation with her and her sister, who was sitting opposite him. Madame Sviashky was a round-faced, fair-haired, rather short woman, all smiles and dimples. Levin tried through her to get at a solution of the weighty enigma her husband presented to his mind, but he had not complete freedom of ideas because he was in an agony of embarrassment. This agony of embarrassment was due to the fact that the sister-in-law was sitting opposite to him, in a dress specially put on, as he fancied, for his benefit, cut particularly open, in the shape of a trapeze, at her white bosom. This quadrangular opening, in spite of the bosom's being very white, or just because it was very white, deprived Levin of the full use of his faculties. He imagined, probably mistakenly, that this low-necked bodice had been made on his account, and felt that he had no right to look at it, and tried not to look at it, but he felt that he was to blame for the very fact of the low-necked bodice having been made. It seemed to Levin that he had imposed upon someone, that he ought to explain something, but that to explain it was impossible, and for that reason he was continually blushing, was ill at ease and awkward. His awkwardness infected the pretty sister-in-law, too, but their hostess appeared not to observe this and kept purposely drawing her into the conversation. "You say," she said, pursuing the subject that had been started, "that my husband cannot be interested in what's Russian. It's quite the contrary. He is in cheerful spirits abroad, but never in such as he is here. Here he feels in his proper place. He has so much to do, and he has the faculty of interesting himself in everything. Oh, you've not been to see our school, have you? I've seen it, the little house covered with ivy, isn't it?" "Yes, that's Nastya's work," she said, indicating her sister. "You teaching it yourself?" asked Levin, trying to look above the open net, but feeling that no matter where he looked in that direction, he should see it. "Yes, I used to teach in it myself, and do teach still, but we have a first-rate schoolmistress now, and we've started gymnastic exercises." "No, thank you, I won't have any more tea," said Levin, and conscious of doing a rude thing, but incapable of continuing the conversation, he got up, blushing. "I hear a very interesting conversation," he added, and walked to the other end of the table, where Sviashky was sitting with the 2 gentlemen of the neighborhood. Sviashky was sitting sideways with 1 elbow on the table and a cup in 1 hand, while with the other hand he gathered up his beard, held it to his nose, and let it drop again, as though he were smelling it. His brilliant back eyes were looking directly at the excited country gentleman with gray mustaches, and apparently he derived amusement from his remarks. The gentleman was complaining of the peasants. It was evident to Levin that Sviashky knew the answer to this gentleman's complaints, which would at once demolish his whole contention, but that in his position he could not give utterance to his answer and listened, not without pleasure, to the landowner's comic talk. The gentleman with the gray mustaches was obviously an inveterate adherent of serfdom and a devoted agriculturist who had lived all his life in the country. Levin saw proofs of this in his dress, in his old-fashioned threadbare coat, obviously not his everyday attire, in his shrewd, deep-set eyes, in his coherent Russian, in the imperious tone that had become habitual from long use, and in the resolute gestures of his large, beautiful, sunburned hands with a single old wedding ring on his fourth finger. Chapter 27. If I'd only the heart to throw up what's been set going, such a lot of trouble wasted, I'd turn my back on the whole business, sell out, go off like Nikolai Ivanovich, to hear La Belle Helene, said the landowner, a pleasant smile lighting up his shrewd old face. But you see, you don't throw it up, said Nikolai Ivanovich Zelyashvili, so there must be something gained. The only gain is that I live in my own house, neither bought nor hired. Besides, one keeps hoping the people will learn sense. Though instead of that, believe it or not, there is such drunkenness, such immorality. They keep making partition of their bits of land. There isn't a horse or a cow. The peasant's dying of hunger, but just go and take him on as a laborer. He'll do his best to do you a mischief, and then bring you up before the justice of the peace. But then you make complaints to the justice, too, said Sviatsky. I lodge complaints? Not for anything in the world. There's so much talk springs up that one is sorry ever to have complained. At the works, for instance, they pocketed the advance money and made off. What did the justice do? Why, acquitted them. Nothing keeps them in order but their own communal court and their village elder. He'll flog them in the good old style. But for that, there'd be nothing for it but to give it all up and run away. Obviously, the landowner was chafing Sviatsky, who, far from resenting it, was apparently amused by it. But you see, we manage our land without much extreme measures, said he, smiling. Levin and I, and this gentleman, he indicated the other landowner. Yes, the thing done at Mikhail Petrovich's, but ask him how it's done. Do you call that a rational system, said the landowner, obviously rather proud of the word rational. My system's very simple, said Mikhail Petrovich, thank God. All my management rests on getting the money ready for the autumn taxes. The peasants come to me. Father, master, help us. Well, the peasants are all one's neighbors. One feels for them. So one advances them a third, but one says, remember, lads, I have helped you, and you must help me when I need it, whether it's the sowing of the oats or the hay cutting or the harvest. And, well, one agrees, so much for each taxpayer, though there are dishonest ones among them, too, it's true. Levin, who had long been familiar with his patriarchal methods, exchanged glances with Sviatsky and interrupted Mikhail Petrovich, turning again to the gentleman with the gray mustaches. Well, what do you think, he asked. What system is one to adopt nowadays? Why, manage like Mikhail Petrovich, or let the land for half the crop, or for rent to the peasants. One can do that, only that's just how the general prosperity of the country is being ruined. Where the land with serf labor and good management gave a yield of 9 to 1, on the Mitayev system it yields 3 to 1. Russia has been ruined by the emancipation. Sviatsky looked with smiling eyes at Levin and even made a faint gesture of irony to him. But Levin did not think the landowner's words absurd. He understood them better than he did Sviatsky. A great deal more of what the landowner said to show in what way Russia was ruined by the emancipation struck him indeed as very true, new to him and quite incontestable. The landowner unmistakably spoke his own individual thought, a thing that rarely happens, and a thought to which he had been brought not by a desire of finding some exercise for an idle brain, but a thought which had grown up out of the conditions of his life, which he had brooded over in the solitude of his village, and had considered in every aspect. The point is, don't you see, that progress of every sort is only made by the use of authority, he said, evidently wishing to show he was not without culture. Take the reforms of Peter, of Catherine, of Alexander. Take European history. And progress in agriculture more than anything else, the potato, for instance, that was introduced among us by force. The wooden plow, too, wasn't always used. It was introduced in the days of appanage princes, perhaps, but it was probably brought in by force. Now, in our own day, we landowners in the serf times used various improvements in our husbandry, drying machines and threshing machines and carting manure and all the modern implements. All these we brought into use by our authority, and the peasants opposed it at first and ended by imitating us. Now, by the abolition of serfdom, we have been deprived of our authority, and so our husbandry. Where it had been raised to a high level is bound to sink to the most savage primitive condition. That's how I see it. But why so? If it's rational, you'll be able to keep up the same system with hired labor, said Sviashki. We've no power over them. With whom am I going to work the system? Allow me to ask. There it is, the labor force, the chief element in agriculture, thought Levin. With laborers. The laborers won't work well and won't work with good implements. Our laborer can do nothing but get drunk like a swine and then ruin everything you give him. He spoils the horses by watering unseasonably. He cuts good harness, barters the tires of the wheels for drink, drops bits of iron into the threshing machine so as to break it. He loathes the sight of anything that's not after his fashion. And that's how the whole level of husbandry has fallen. Lands gone out of cultivation, overgrown with weeds, are divided among the peasants, and where millions of shepherds were raised, you get 100,000. The wealth of the country has decreased. If the same thing had been done, but with consideration for it, and he proceeded to unfold his own scheme of emancipation, by means of which these drawbacks might have been avoided. This did not interest Levin, but when he had finished, Levin went back to his first position, and addressing Sviashki and trying to draw him into expressing his serious opinion, said, "It's perfectly true that the standard of culture is falling, and that with our present relations to the peasants there is no possibility of farming on a rational system to yield a profit," said he. "I don't believe it," said Sviashki, replied quite seriously. "All I see is that we don't know how to cultivate the land, and that our system of agriculture in the serf days was by no means too high but too low. We have no machines, no good stock, no efficient supervision. We don't even know how to keep accounts. Ask any landowner. He won't be able to tell you which crop's profitable and which isn't." "Italian bookkeeping," said the landowner ironically. "You may keep your books as you like, but if they spoil everything for you, there won't be any profit." "Why do they spoil things? A poor threshing machine or your Russian presser, they will break, but my steam press, they don't break. A wretched Russian nag, they'll ruin, but keep good Percherons or the Russian wagon horses, they won't ruin them." And so it is all round. We must raise our farming to a higher level. "Oh, if one only had the means to do it, Nikolai Ivanovich. It's all very well for you, but for me, with a son to keep at the university, lads to be educated at the high school, how am I going to buy these Percherons?" "Well, that's what the banks are for." "To get whatever I have left sold by auction? No, thank you." "I don't agree that it's necessary or possible to raise the level of agriculture still higher," said Levin. "I devote myself to it, and I have means, but I can do nothing. As to the banks, I don't know to whom they're any good. For my part, anyway, whatever I've spent money on in the way of husbandry has been a loss. Stock, a loss. Machinery, a loss." "That's true enough," the gentleman with the gray mustaches chimed in, even laughing with satisfaction. "And I'm not the only one," pursued Levin. "I mix with all the neighboring landowners, who are cultivating their land on a rational system. They all, with rare exceptions, are doing so at a loss." "Come, tell us, how does your land do? Does it pay?" said Levin, and at once Sviashki's eyes he detected that fleeting expression of alarm which he had noticed whenever he had tried to penetrate beyond the outer chambers of Sviashki's mind. Moreover, this question on Levin's part was not quite in good faith. Madame Sviashki had just told him at tea that they had, that summer, invited a German expert accountant from Moscow, who, for a consideration of 500 rubles, had investigated the management of their property, and found that it was costing them a loss of 3,000 odd rubles. She did not remember the precise sum, but it appeared that the German had worked it out to the fraction of a kopeck. The landowner smiled at the mention of the profits of Sviashky's farming, obviously aware how much gain his neighbor and marshal are likely to be making. "Possibly it does not pay," answered Sviashky. "That merely proves that either I'm a bad manager or that I've sunk my capital for the increase of my rents." "Oh, rent," Levin cried with horror. "Rent there may be in Europe, where land has been improved by the labor put into it. But with us, all the land is deteriorating from the labor put into it. In other words, they're working it out, so there's no question of rent." "How? No rent. It's a law." "Then we're outside the law. Rent explains nothing for us, but simply muddles us. No, tell me how there can be a theory of rent." "Will you have some curded milk?" Masha passed us some curded milk, or raspberries. He turned to his wife. "The raspberries are lasting extraordinarily late this year." And in the happiest frame of mind, Sviashky got up and walked off, apparently supposing the conversation to have ended at the very point when to Levin it seemed it was only just beginning. Having lost his antagonist, Levin continued the conversation with the landowner, trying to prove to him that all the difficulty arises from the fact that we don't find out the peculiarities and habits of our laborer. But the landowner, like all men who think independently and in isolation, was slow in taking in any other person's thought, and particularly partial to his own. He stuck to it that the Russian peasant is a swine and likes swinishness, and that to get him out of his swinishness, one must have authority, and there is none. One must have the stick, and we have become so liberal that we have all of a sudden replaced the stick that served us for 1,000 years with lawyers and model prisons, where the worthless, stinking peasant is fed on good soup and has a fixed allowance of cubic feet of air. "What makes you think," said Levin, trying to get back to the question, "that it's impossible to find some relation to the laborer in which the labor would become productive?" "That never could be so with the Russian people. We've no authority," answered the landowner. "How can new conditions be found?" says Sviashky. Having eaten some curded milk and lighted a cigarette, he came back to the discussion. "All possible relations to the labor force have been defined and studied," he said. "The relic of barbarism, the primitive commune with a guarantee for all, will disappear of itself. Serfdom has been abolished. There remains nothing but free labor, and its forms are fixed and ready-made and must be adopted. Permanent hands, day laborers, farmers, you can't get out of these forms." "But Europe is dissatisfied with these forms." "Dissatisfied and seeking new ones, and will find them in all probability." "That's just what I meant," answered Levin. "Why shouldn't we seek them for ourselves?" "Because it would be just like inventing afresh the means for constructing railways. They are ready, invented." "But if they don't suit us, if they're stupid," said Levin, and again he detected the expression of alarm in the eyes of Sviashky. "Oh yes, we'll bury the world under our caps. We've found the secret Europe was seeking for. I've heard all that. But excuse me, do you know all that's been done in Europe in the question of the organization of labor?" "No, very little." "That question is now absorbing the best minds in Europe. The Schulz-Dillich movement, and then all this enormous literature of the labor question, the most liberal LaSalle movement, the Mulhausen experiment, that's a fact by now, as you're probably aware." "I have some idea of it, but very vague." "No, you only say that. No doubt you know all about it as well as I do. I'm no professor of sociology, of course, but it interested me, and really, if it interests you, you ought to study it." "But what conclusion have they come to?" "Excuse me?" The two neighbors had risen, and Sviashky, once more checking Levin in his inconvenient habit of peeping into what was beyond the outer chambers of his mind, went to see his guests out. Chapter 28. Levin was insufferably bored that evening with the ladies. He was stirred as he had never been before by the idea that the dissatisfaction he was feeling with his system of managing his land was not an exceptional case, but the general condition of things in Russia. that the evolving of some relation of the laborers to the soil which would work, as with the peasant he had met halfway to the Sviazhskys, was not a dream, but a problem which must be solved, and it seemed to him that the problem could be solved and that he ought to try to solve it. After saying good night to the ladies and promising to stay the whole of the next day, so as to make an expedition on horseback with them to see an interesting gap in the Crown Forest, Levin went, before going to bed, into his host's study to get the books on the labor question that Sviazhsky had offered him. Sviazhsky's study was a huge room, 5 bookcases and with 2 tables in it, one a massive writing table standing in the middle of the room, and the other a round table covered with recent numbers of reviews and journals in different languages, ranged like the rays of a star round a lamp. On the writing table was a stand of drawers marked with gold labels and full of papers of various sorts. Sviazhsky took out the books and sat down in a rocking chair. "What are you looking at there?" he said to Levin, who was standing at the round table looking through the reviews. "Oh, yes, there's a very interesting article here," said Sviazhsky, pointing to the review Levin was holding in his hand. "It appears," he went on with eager interest, "that Friedrich was not, after all, the person chiefly responsible for the partition of Poland. It is proved," and with his characteristic clearness he summed up those new, very important, and interesting revelations. Although Levin was engrossed at the moment by his ideas about the problem of the land, he wondered, as he heard Sviazhsky, what is there inside of him, and why is he interested in the partition of Poland? When Sviazhsky had finished, Levin could not help asking, "Well, and what then?" But there was nothing to follow. It was simply interesting that such and such had been proved. But Sviazhsky did not explain and saw no need of explaining why it was interesting to him. "Yes, but I was very much interested in your irritable neighbor," said Levin, sighing. "He's a clever fellow and said a lot that was true." "Oh, get along with you. An inveterate supporter of serfdom at heart, like all of them," said Sviazhsky. "Whose marshal are you?" "Yes, only I marshal them in the other direction," said Sviazhsky, laughing. "I'll tell you what interests me very much," said Levin. "He's right that our system, that is to say, of rational farming, doesn't answer. That's the only thing that answers is the moneylender system, like that meek-looking gentleman's, or else the very simplest. Whose fault is it?" "Our own, of course. Besides, it's not true that it doesn't answer. It answers with Vasilshikov. A factory? But I really don't know what it is you're surprised at. The people are at such a low stage of material and moral development that obviously they're bound to oppose everything that's necessary to them. In Europe, a rational system answers because the people are educated. It follows that we must educate the people. That's all. But how are we to educate the people? To educate the people, 3 things are needed. Schools and schools and schools. But you said yourself the people are at such a low stage of material development. What help are schools for that? Do you know, you remind me of the story of the advice given to the sick man. You should try purgative medicine. Taken it? Worse. Try leeches. Tried them? Worse. Well, then, there's nothing left but to pray to God. Tried it? Worse. I say political economy. You say worse. I say socialism, worse. Education, worse. But how do schools help matters? They give the peasant fresh wants. Well, that's a thing I've never understood, Levin replied with heat. In what way are schools going to help the people to improve their material position? You say schools' education will give them fresh wants. So much the worse, since they won't be capable of satisfying them. And in what way a knowledge of addition and subtraction in the catechism is going to improve their material condition, I never could make out. The day before yesterday, I met a peasant woman in the evening with a little baby and asked her where she was going. She said she was going to the wise woman. Her boy had screaming fits, so she was taking him to be doctored. I asked, "Why, how does the wise woman cure screaming fits?" She put the child on the hen roost and repeats some charm. Well, you're saying it yourself. What's wanted to prevent her taking her child to the hen roost to cure it of screaming fits is just, Sviazhsky said, smiling good-humoredly, Oh, no, said Levin with annoyance. That method of doctoring I merely meant as a simile for doctoring the people with schools. The people are poor and ignorant. That we see as surely as the peasant woman sees the baby has fits because it screams. But in what way this trouble of poverty and ignorance is to be cured by schools is as incomprehensible as how the hen roost affects the screaming. What has to be cured is what makes him poor. Well, in that, at least, you're in agreement with Spencer, whom you dislike so much. He says, too, that education may be the consequence of greater prosperity and comfort, of more frequent washings, as he says, but not of being able to read and write. Well, then, I'm very glad, or the contrary, very sorry, that I'm in agreement with Spencer. Only I've known it a long while. Schools can do no good. What will do good is an economic organization in which the people will become richer, will have more leisure, and then there will be schools. Still, all over Europe now, schools are obligatory. And how far do you agree with Spencer yourself about it? Asked Levin. But there was a gleam of alarm in Savyashvili's eyes, and he said, smiling, No, that screaming story is positively capital. Did you really hear it yourself? Levin saw that he was not to discover the connection between this man's life and his thoughts. Obviously, he did not care in the least what his reasoning led him to. All he wanted was the process of reasoning, and he did not like it when the process of reasoning brought him into a blind alley. That was the only thing he disliked and avoided by changing the conversation to something agreeable and amusing. All the impressions of the day, beginning with the impression made by the old peasant, which served, as it were, as the thorough base of all the conceptions and ideas of the day, threw Levin into violent excitement. This dear, good Savyashvili, keeping a stock of ideas simply for public purposes, and obviously having some other principles hidden from Levin, while with the crowd, whose name is Legion, he guided public opinion by ideas he did not share. That irascible country gentleman, perfectly correct in the conclusions that he had been worried into by life, but wrong in his exasperation against a whole class, and that the best class in Russia, his own dissatisfaction with the work he had been doing, and the vague hope of finding a remedy for all this, all was blended in a sense of inward turmoil, and the anticipation of some solution near at hand. Left alone in the room assigned him, lying on a spring mattress that yielded unexpectedly at every movement of his arm or his leg, Levin did not fall asleep for a long while. Not one conversation with Savyashvili, though he had said a great deal that was clever, had interested Levin. But the conclusions of the irascible landowner required consideration. Levin could not help recalling every word he had said and in imagination amending his own replies. Yes, I ought to have said to him, You say that our husbandry does not answer because the peasant hates improvements, and that they must be forced on him by authority. If no system of husbandry answered at all without these improvements, you would be quite right. But the only system that does answer is when the laborer is working in accordance with his habits, just as on the old peasant's land halfway here. Your and our general dissatisfaction with the system shows that either we are to blame or the laborers. We have gone our way, the European way, a long while, without asking ourselves about the qualities of our labor force. Let us try to look upon the labor force not as an abstract force, but as the Russian muzhik with his instincts, and let us arrange our system of agriculture in accordance with that. Imagine, I ought to have said to him, that you have the same system as the old peasant has, that you have found means of making your laborers take an interest in the success of the work, and have found the happy mean in the way of improvements which they will admit, and you will, without exhausting the soil, get twice or three times the yield you got before. Divided in halves, give half as the share of labor. The surplus left you will be greater, and labor's share will be greater too. And to do this, one must lower the standard of husbandry and interest the laborers in its success. How to do this? That's a matter of detail, but undoubtedly it can be done. This idea threw Levin into a great excitement. He did not sleep half the night, thinking over in detail the putting of his idea into practice. He had not intended to go away next day, but he now determined to go home early in the morning. Besides, the sister-in-law with her low-neck bodice aroused in him a feeling akin to shame and remorse for some utterly base action. Most important of all, he must get back without delay. He would have to make haste to put his new project to the peasants before the sowing of the winter wheat, so that the sowing might be undertaken on a new basis. He had made up his mind to revolutionize his whole system. Chapter 29. The carrying out of Levin's plan presented many difficulties, but he struggled on, doing his utmost, and attained a result which, though not what he desired, was enough to enable him, without self-deception, to believe that the attempt was worth the trouble. One of the chief difficulties was that the process of cultivating the land was in full swing, that it was impossible to stop everything and begin it all again from the beginning, and the machine had to be mended while in motion. When on the evening of his arrival home he informed the bailiff of his plans, the latter with visible pleasure agreed with what he said, so long as he was pointing out that all that had been done up to that time was stupid and useless. The bailiff said that he had said so a long while ago, but no heed had been paid to him. But as for the proposal made by Levin, to take part as shareholder with his laborers in each agricultural undertaking, at this the bailiff simply expressed a profound despondency and offered no definite opinion, but began immediately talking of the urgent necessity of carrying the remaining sheaves of rye the next day and of sending the men out for the second plowing, so that Levin felt that this was not the time for discussing it. On beginning to talk to the peasants about it and making a proposition to cede them the land on new terms, he came into collision with the same great difficulty, that they were so much absorbed by the current work of the day that they had not time to consider the advantages and disadvantages of the proposed scheme. The simple-hearted Ivan, the cowherd, seemed to grasp Levin's proposal fully, that he should with his family take a share of the profits of the cattle yard, and he was in complete sympathy with the plan. But when Levin hinted at the future advantages, Ivan's face expressed alarm and regret that he could not hear all he had to say, and he made haste to find himself some task that would admit of no delay. He either snatched up the fork to pitch the hay out of the pens, or ran to get water or to clear out the manure. Another difficulty lay in the invincible disbelief of the peasants that a landowner's object could be anything else than a desire to squeeze all he could out of them. They were firmly convinced that his real aim, whatever he might say to them, would always be in what he did not say to them. And they themselves, in giving their opinion, said a great deal but never said what was their real object. Moreover, Levin felt that the irascible landowner had been right. The peasants made their first and unalterable condition of any agreement whatsoever that they should not be forced to any new methods of tillage of any kind, nor to use new implements. They agreed that the modern plow plowed better, that the scarifier did the work more quickly, but they found thousands of reasons that made it out of the question for them to use either of them. And though he had accepted the conviction that he would have to lower the standard of cultivation, he felt sorry to give up improved methods, the advantages of which were so obvious. But in spite of all these difficulties, he got his way, and by autumn the system was working, or at least so it seemed to him. At first, Levin had thought of giving up the whole farming of the land just as it was to the peasants, the laborers, and the bailiff, on new conditions of partnership. But he was very soon convinced that this was impossible and determined to divide it up. The cattle yard, the garden, hay fields, and arable land, divided into several parts, had to be made into separate lots. The simple-hearted cowherd, Ivan, who Levin fancied, understood the matter better than any of them. Collecting together a gang of workers to help him, principally of his own family, became a partner in the cattle yard. A distant part of the estate, a tract of wasteland that had lain fallow for 8 years, was, with the help of the clever carpenter, Fyodor Rezanov, taken by 6 families of peasants on new conditions of partnership, and the peasant, Shireyev, took the management of all the vegetable gardens on the same terms. The remainder of the land was still worked on the old system, but these three items were the first step to a new organization of the whole, and they completely engrossed Levin. It is true that in the cattle yard things went no better than before, and Ivan strenuously opposed warm housing for the cows and butter made of fresh cream, affirming that cows require less food if kept cold, and that butter is more profitable made from sour cream. And he asked for wages just as under the old system, and took not the slightest interest in the fact that the money he received was not wages, but an advance out of his future share in the profits. It is true that Fyodor Reznov's company did not plow over the ground twice before sowing, as had been agreed, justifying themselves on the plea that the time was too short. It is true that the peasants of the same company, though they had agreed to work the land on new conditions, always spoke of the land not as held in partnership, but as rented for half the crop, and more than once the peasants and Reznov himself said to Levin, "If you would take a rent for the land, it would save you trouble, and we should be more free." Moreover, the same peasants kept putting off on various excuses the building of a cattle yard and threshing barn on the land as agreed upon, and delayed doing it till the winter. It is true that Shuraev would have liked to let out the kitchen gardens he had undertaken in small lots to the peasants. He evidently quite misunderstood, and apparently intentionally misunderstood, the conditions upon which the land had been given to him. Often, too, talking to the peasants and explaining to them all the advantages of the plan, Levin felt that the peasants heard nothing but the sound of his voice, and were firmly resolved, whatever he might say, not to let themselves be taken in. He felt this especially when he talked to the cleverest of the peasants, Ruzanov, and detected that gleam in Ruzanov's eyes which showed so plainly both ironical amusement at Levin and the firm conviction that, if anyone were to be taken in, it would not be he, Reznov. But in spite of all this, Levin thought the system worked, and that by keeping accounts strictly and insisting on his own way, he would prove to them in the future the advantages of the arrangement, and then the system would go on of itself. These matters, together with the management of the land still left on his hands, and the indoor work over his book, so engrossed Levin the whole summer that he scarcely ever went out shooting. At the end of August, he heard that the Oblonskys had gone away to Moscow from their servant, who brought back the side saddle. He felt that in not answering Darya Alexandrovna's letter, he had, by his rudeness, of which he could not think without a flush of shame, burned his ships, and that he would never go to see them again. He had been just as rude with the Sviashkys, leaving them without saying goodbye, but he would never go to see them again either. He did not care about that now. The business of reorganizing the farming of his land absorbed him as completely as though there would never be anything else in his life. He read the books lent him by Sviashky, and ordering from Moscow what he had not had, he read both the economic and socialistic books on the subject, but, as he had anticipated, found nothing bearing on the scheme he had undertaken. In the books on political economy, in Mill, for instance, whom he studied first with great ardor, hoping every minute to find an answer to the questions that were engrossing him, he found laws deduced from the condition of land culture in Europe, but he did not see why these laws, which did not apply in Russia, must be general. He saw just the same thing in the socialistic books. Either they were the beautiful but impractical fantasies which had fascinated him when he was a student, or they were attempts at improving, at rectifying the economic position in which Europe was placed, with which the system of land tenure in Russia had nothing in common. Political economy told him that the laws by which the wealth of Europe had been developed and was developing were universal and unvarying. Socialism told him that development along these lines leads to ruin, and neither of them gave an answer, or even a hint, in reply to the question as to what he, Levin, and all the Russian peasants and landowners were to do with their millions of hands and millions of desiatinas, to make them as productive as possible for the common weal. Having once taken the subject up, he read conscientiously everything bearing on it, and intended in the autumn to go abroad to study land systems on the spot, in order that he might not, on this question, be confronted with what so often met him on various subjects. Often, just as he was beginning to understand the idea in the mind of anyone he was talking to, and was beginning to explain his own, he would suddenly be told, "But Kaufman, but Jones, but Dubois, but Michelli, you haven't read them. Do read. They've thrashed that question out thoroughly." He saw now distinctly that Kaufman and Michelli had nothing to tell him. He knew what he wanted. He saw that Russia had splendid land, splendid laborers, and that in certain cases, as at the peasants on the way to Sviashky's, the produce raised by the laborers and the land is great. In the majority of cases, when capital is applied in the European way, the produce is small, and that this simply arises from the fact that the laborers want to work and work well only on their peculiar way, and that this antagonism is not incidental but invariable, and has its roots in the national spirit. He thought that the Russian people, whose task it was to colonize and cultivate vast tracts of unoccupied land, consciously adhered, till all their land was occupied, to the methods suitable to their purpose, and that their methods were by no means so bad as was generally supposed, and he wanted to prove this theoretically in his book and practically on his land. Chapter 30. At the end of September, the timber had been carted for building the cattle yard on the land that had been allotted to the Association of Peasants, and the butter from the cows was sold and the profits divided. In practice, the system worked capitally, or at least so it seemed to Levin. In order to work out the whole subject theoretically and to complete his book, which, in Levin's daydreams, was not merely to effect a revolution in political economy, but to annihilate that science entirely and to lay the foundation of a new science of the relation of the people to the soil, all that was left to do was to make a tour abroad and to study on the spot all that had been done in the same direction, and to collect conclusive evidence that all that had been done there was not what was wanted. Levin was only waiting for the delivery of his wheat to receive the money for it and go abroad, but the rains began preventing the harvesting of the corn and potatoes left in the fields, and putting a stop to all work, even to the delivery of the wheat. The mud was impassable along the roads. Two mills were carried away by the spate, and the weather got worse and worse. On the 30th of September, the sun came out in the morning, and hoping for fine weather, Levin began making final preparations for his journey. He gave orders for the wheat to be delivered, sent the bailiff to the merchant to get the money owing him, and went out himself to give some final directions on the estate before setting off. Having finished all his business, soaked through with the streams of water which kept running into his leather coat and down his neck and his boot tops, but in the keenest and most confident temper, Levin turned homeward in the evening. The weather had become worse than ever toward evening. The hail lashed and drenched mare so cruelly that she went along sideways, shaking her head and ears. But Levin was all right under his hood, and he looked cheerfully about him at the muddy streams running under the wheels, at the drops hanging on every bare twig, at the whiteness of the patch of unmelted hailstones on the planks of the bridge, at the thick layer of still succulent, fleshy leaves that lay heaped up upon the stripped elm tree. In spite of the gloominess of nature around him, he felt peculiarly eager. The talks he had been having with the peasants in the farther village had shown that they were beginning to get used to their new position. The innkeeper, an old man, to whose inn he had gone to get dry, evidently approved of Levin's plan, and of his own accord proposed to enter the partnership for purchasing of cattle. "I have only to go on stubbornly toward my aim, and I shall attain my end," thought Levin, "and it's something to work and take trouble for. This is not a matter of myself individually. The question of the public welfare comes into it. The whole system of agriculture, the chief element in the condition of the people, must be completely transformed. Instead of poverty, general prosperity and content. Instead of hostility, harmony and unity of interests. In short, a bloodless revolution, but a revolution of the greatest magnitude, beginning in the little circle of our district, then the province, then Russia, and the whole world. Because a just idea cannot but be fruitful. Yes, it's an aim worth working for. And the fact that it is, I, Kostya Levin, who went to a ball in a black tie and was refused by the Sherbatsky girl, and who is intrinsically such a pitiful, worthless creature to himself, that proves nothing. I feel sure Franklin felt just as worthless, and he too had no faith in himself, thinking of himself as a whole. That means nothing. And he too, most likely, had an Agatha Mikhailovna to whom he confided his secrets. Musing on such thoughts, Levin reached home in the darkness. The bailiff, who had been to the merchant, had come back and brought part of the money for the wheat. An agreement had been made with the old innkeeper, and on the road the bailiff had learned that everywhere the corn was still standing in the fields, so that his 160 shocks that had not been carried were nothing in comparison with the losses of others. After dinner, Levin was sitting, as he usually did, in an easy chair with a book, and as he read, he went on thinking of the journey before him in connection with his book. Today, all the significance of his book rose before him with special distinctness, and whole periods ranged themselves in his mind in illustration of his theories. I must write that down, he thought. That ought to form a brief introduction, which I thought unnecessary before. He got up to go to his writing table, and Laska, laying at his feet, got up too, stretching and looking at him as though to inquire where to go. But he had not time to write it down, for the overseers had come for receiving orders, and Levin went out into the hall to meet them. After giving orders, that is to say, directions about the labors of the next day, and seeing all the peasants who had business with him, Levin went back to his study and sat down to work. Laska lay under the table. Agatha Mikhailovna settled herself in her place with her stocking. After writing for a little while, Levin suddenly thought with exceptional vividness of Kitty, her refusal, and their last meeting. He got up and began walking about the room. "What's the use of being downhearted?" said Agatha Mikhailovna. "Come, why do you stay on at home? You ought to go to some warm springs, especially now that you're ready for the journey." "Well, I am going away the day after tomorrow, Agatha Mikhailovna. I must finish my work." "There, there, your work, you say, as if you hadn't done enough for the peasants. Why, as 'tis their saying, your master will be getting some honor from the Tsar for it. Indeed, 'tis a strange thing. Why need you worry about the peasants?" "I'm not worrying about them. I'm doing it for my own good." Agatha Mikhailovna knew every detail of Levin's plans for his land. Levin often put his views before her in all their complexity, and not uncommonly he argued with her and did not agree with her comments. But on this occasion she entirely misinterpreted what he had said. "Of one soul's salvation we all know and must think before all else," she said with a sigh. Parfion Denisich, now, for all he was no scholar, died a death whose like may God grant to every one of us, she said, referring to a servant who had died recently. Took the sacrament and all. "That's not what I mean," said he. "I mean that I'm acting for my own advantage. It's all the better for me if the peasants do their work better." "Well, whatever you do, if he's a lazy good for naught, everything will be at sixes and sevens. If he has a conscience, he'll work, and if not, there's no doing anything." "Oh, come, you say yourself Ivan has begun looking after the cattle better." "All I say is," answered Agatha Mikhailovna, evidently not speaking at random but in strict sequence of ideas, "that you ought to get married. That's what I say." Agatha Mikhailovna's allusion to the very subject he had only just been thinking about hurt and stung him. Levin scowled, and without answering her, he sat down again to his work, repeating to himself all that he had been thinking of the real significance of that work. Only at intervals he listened in the stillness to the click of Agatha Mikhailovna's needles, and recollecting what he did not want to remember, he would frown again. At 9 o'clock they heard the bell and the faint vibration of a carriage over the mud. "Well, here's visitors come to us, and you won't be dull," said Agatha Mikhailovna, getting up and going to the door. But Levin overtook her. His work was not going well now, and he was glad of a visitor, whoever it might be. Chapter 31. Running halfway down the staircase, Levin caught a sound he knew, a familiar cough in the hall. But he heard it indistinctly through the sound of his own footsteps and hoped he was mistaken. Then he caught sight of a long, bony, familiar figure, and now it seemed there was no possibility of mistake. And yet he still went on hoping that this tall man taking off his fur cloak and coughing was not his brother Nikolai. Levin loved his brother, but being with him was always a torture. Just now, when Levin, under the influence of the thoughts that had come to him, and Agatha Mikhailovna's hint, was in a troubled and uncertain humor, this meeting with his brother, which he had to face, seemed particularly difficult. Instead of a lively, healthy visitor, some outsider who would, he hoped, cheer him up in his uncertain humor, he had to see his brother, who knew him through and through, who would call forth all the thoughts nearest his heart, would force him to show himself fully, and that he was not disposed to do. Angry with himself for so base a feeling, Levin ran into the hall. As soon as he had seen his brother close, this feeling of selfish disappointment vanished instantly and was replaced by pity. Terrible as his brother Nikolai had been before in his emaciation and sickliness, now he looked still more emaciated, still more wasted. He was a skeleton covered by skin. He stood in the hall, jerking his long, thin neck and pulling the scarf off it, and smiled a strange and pitiful smile. When he saw that smile, submissive and humble, Levin felt something clutching at his throat. "You see, I've come to you," said Nikolai in a thick voice, never for one second taking his eyes off his brother's face. "I've been meaning to a long while, but I've been constantly unwell. Now I'm ever so much better," he said, rubbing his beard with his big, thin hands. "Yes, yes," answered Levin, and he felt still more frightened when kissing him. He felt his lips, the dryness of his brother's skin, and saw close to him his big eyes, full of a strange light. A few weeks before, Konstantin Levin had written to his brother that, through the sale of the small part of the property that had remained undivided, there was a sum of about 2,000 rubles to come to him as his share. Nikolai said that he had come now to take his money and, what was more important, to stay a while in the old nest, to get in touch with the earth, so as to renew his strength like the heroes of old for the work that lay before him. In spite of his exaggerated stoop and the emaciation that was so striking from his height, his movements were as rapid and abrupt as ever. Levin led him into his study. His brother dressed with particular care, a thing he never used to do, combed his scanty, lank hair, and smiling went upstairs. He was in the most affectionate and good-humored mood, just as Levin often remembered him in childhood. He even referred to Sergei Ivanovich without rancor. When he saw Agatha Mikhailovna, he joked with her and asked after the old servants. The news of the death of Parfen Denisovich made a painful impression on him. A look of fear crossed his face, but he regained his serenity immediately. "Of course, he was quite old," he said, and changed the subject. "Well, I'll spend a month or two with you, and then I'm off to Moscow. Do you know, Nyakov has promised me a place there, and I'm going into the service. Now I'm going to arrange my life quite differently," he went on. "You know, I got rid of that woman." "Maria Nikolaevna? Why, what for?" "Oh, she was a horrid woman. She caused me all sorts of annoyances." But he did not say what the annoyances were. He could not say that he had driven off Maria Nikolaevna because the tea was weak, and above all, because she would look after him as though he were an invalid. "Besides, I want to turn over a new leaf completely now. I've done silly things, of course, like everyone else, but money's the last consideration. I don't regret it, so long as their health, and my health, thank God, is quite restored." Levin listened and racked his brains, but could think of nothing to say. Nikolai probably felt the same. He began questioning his brother about his affairs, and Levin was glad to talk about himself, because then he could speak without hypocrisy. He told his brother of his plans and his doings. His brother listened, but evidently was not interested. These two men were so akin, so near each other, that the slightest gesture, the tone of voice, told both more than could be said in words. Both of them now had only one thought, the illness of Nikolai and the nearness of his death, which stifled all else, but neither of them dared speak of it. And so whatever they said, without uttering the one thought that filled their minds, was all falsehood. Never had Levin been so glad when the evening was over and it was time to go to bed. Never with any outside person, never on any official list, had he been so unnatural and false as he was that evening. And the consciousness of his unnaturalness and the remorse he felt at it made him even more unnatural. He wanted to weep over his dying, dearly beloved brother, and he had to listen and keep on talking of how he meant to live. As the house was damp and only the one bedroom had been kept heated, Levin put his brother to sleep in his own bedroom behind a partition. His brother got into bed, and whether he slept or did not sleep, tossed about like a sick man, coughed, and when he could not get his throat clear, mumbled something. Sometimes when his breathing was painful, he said, "Oh, my God." Sometimes when he was choking, he muttered angrily, "Ah, the devil." Levin could not sleep for a long while hearing him. His thoughts were of the most various kinds, but the end of all his thoughts was the same, death. Death, the inevitable end of all, for the first time presented itself to him with irresistible force. And death, which was here in this beloved brother, groaning, half asleep, and from habit calling without distinction on God and the devil, was not so remote as it had hitherto seemed to him. It was in himself, too, that he felt this. If not today, tomorrow. If not tomorrow, in 30 years. Wasn't it all the same? And what was this inevitable death? He did not know, had never thought about it, and what was more, had not the power, had not the courage to think about it. I work, I want to do something, but I had forgotten it must all end. I had forgotten death. He sat on his bed in the darkness, crouched up, hugging his knees and holding his breath from the strain of thought he pondered. But the more intensely he thought, the clearer it became to him that it was indubitably so. That, in reality, looking upon life, he had forgotten one little fact, that death will come, and all ends, that nothing was even worth beginning, and that there was no helping it anyway. Yes, it was awful, but it was so. But I am alive still. What's to be done now? What's to be done? He asked in despair. He lighted a candle, got up cautiously, went to the looking glass, and began looking at his face and hair. Yes, there were gray hairs about his temples. He opened his mouth. His back teeth were beginning to decay. He bared his muscular arms. Yes, there was strength in them. But Nikolenko, who lay there breathing with what was left of his lungs, had had a strong, healthy body, too. And suddenly he recalled how they used to go to bed together as children, and how they only waited till Fyodor Bogdanich was out of the room to fling pillows at each other, and laugh irrepressibly, so that even their awe of Fyodor Bogdanich could not check the effervescing, overbrimming sense of life and happiness. And now that warped, hollow chest, and I, not knowing what will become of me, or wherefore, kaha, 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 damnation, why do you keep fidgeting? Why don't you go to sleep? His brother's voice called to him. Oh, I don't know, I'm not sleepy. I have had a good sleep, I'm not in a sweat now. Just see, feel my shirt, there's no sweat, is there? Levin felt it, withdrew behind the partition, and put out the candle, but for a long while he could not sleep. The question how to live had hardly begun to grow a little clearer to him, when a new, insolvable question presented itself. Death. Why, he's dying. Yes, he'll die in the spring, and how is one to help him? What can I say to him? What do I know about it? I'd even forgotten the very fact of it. Chapter 32. Levin had long before made the observation that when one is uncomfortable with people from their being excessively amenable and meek, one is apt very soon after to find things intolerable from their pretensions and irritability. He felt that this was how it would be with his brother, and his brother Nikolai's gentleness did not, in fact, last out for long. The very next morning he began to be irritable and seemed doing his best to find fault with his brother, attacking him on his tenderest points. Levin felt himself to blame and could not set things right. He felt that if they had both not kept up appearances, but had spoken, as it is called, from the heart, that is to say, had said only just what they were thinking and feeling, they would simply have looked into each other's faces, and Konstantin could only have said, "You're dying, you're dying." And Nikolai could only have answered, "I know I'm dying, but I'm afraid, I'm afraid, I'm afraid." And they could have said nothing more. If they had said only what was in their hearts, But life like that was impossible, and so Constantine tried to do what he had been trying to do all his life, and never could learn to do, though, as far as he could observe, many people know so well how to do it, and without it there was no living at all. He tried to say what he was not thinking, but he felt continually that it had a ring of falsehood, and that his brother detected him in it and was exasperated at it. The third day, Nikolai induced his brother to explain his plan to him again, and again not merely attacking it, but intentionally confounding it with communism. You've simply borrowed an idea that's not your own, but you've distorted it and are trying to apply it where it's not applicable. But I tell you, there's nothing in common. They deny the justice of property, of capital, of inheritance. Well, I do not deny this chief stimulus. Levin felt disgusted himself at using such expressions, but ever since he had been engrossed by his work, he had unconsciously come more and more frequently to use non-Russian words. All I want is to regulate labor, which means you've borrowed an idea, stripped it of all that gave it its force, and want to make believe that it's something new, said Nikolai, angrily tugging at his necktie. But my idea has nothing in common. The other, at any rate, said Nikolai Levin, with an ironical smile, his eyes flashing malignantly, has the charm of, what's one to call it? Geometrical symmetry, of clearness, of definiteness. It may be a utopia. If one once allows the possibility of making all the past a tabula rasa, no property, no family, then labor would organize itself. But you have nothing. Why do you mix things up? I've never been a communist, but I have, and I consider it's premature but rational, and it has a future just like Christianity in its first ages.